Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and in polarized America, is the centrist an endangered species, despite the failure of Simpson Bowles, of a modest gun control bill, and the decline of centrist media? Dartmouth Public Policy Professor Charles Whelan thinks centrism could be the American future. He has a new book called The Centrist Manifesto. Professor Whelan, welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be back with you.
So you spent part of the book giving your opinion of where the Democratic and Republican parties stand for essential truths, as you see it, and where they come off the ideological rails. Can we go through some of that briefly? How would you put, in your words, the essential set of Democratic Party truths and Republican Party truths that you embrace?
Sure. The idea was that a centrist party should not just stand for being nothing or being not one of the others. It should take the best of each party. So to your point, what do we like about the Republicans? Well, as an economist, I like the respect for wealth creation. I like the respect for personal responsibility. I like the skepticism of government that, yes, there are lots of problems, but they're harder to solve than we think. Historically, I like the fiscal rectitude. I would say they've gone off the rails on that one. You can do the same for the Democrats, which is I think their heart is in the right place. We need to care about social mobility, about a real path to prosperity for folks. The Democrats have a better record of social tolerance. They're more realistic about the environmental threats. So I think that there's nothing incompatible about those sets of, as you describe them, really valuable things that each party brings to the table.
And they go awry how?
Well, they each go off the rails. I like your language there. Well, the Republicans are in complete denial on climate change. There is no business person who would look up and say, well, 97% of the experts think there's a problem here. Let's wait till it gets to 100%. At about 10%, any sane person would be hedging your risk. And certainly on some of the social issues, the Republicans are out of sync with young voters, with a lot of folks who describe themselves in the political middle. The Republicans have not been fiscally conscious. They talk a lot about small government but haven't delivered it. And again, you can do the same thing for the Democrats, which is here's the party that talks a lot about the middle class and caring for the disadvantaged. And I would argue they're way too close to the teachers' unions, and that's a force that it stands in opposition to a lot of things that have to happen to provide a better education for kids Democrats are supposed to stand for. Democrats are in denial on what has to happen with entitlements if we really want to keep the essence of those programs. So, yeah, both parties have some diehard positions, which happen to be held most strenuously by those who are the base, the primary voters, and I would cut those loose.
Listeners, anybody out there consider yourself a centrist? You know, when we do things like this on the show, which we do from time to time, it's actually hard to get people to call in. And I think it reflects the fact that people with strong enough views to call talk shows are either more ideologically on the right or more ideologically on the left. They have a strong set of beliefs. And people who consider themselves centrist – somebody else wrote a book, I think, some years ago called The Militant Middle, or coined that phrase, militant middle or militant moderate. And it's hard to find people. So if you consider yourself in the militant middle, or if you think you would sign on to Charles Whelan's Centrist Manifesto, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. And is that the problem, Professor Whelan, that many of the things that you say may seem sensible in an academic discussion, but you have a problem that in the real world, people don't weigh these rational arguments and come down in the middle with complex choices. They come down on the side of their own interests. So a centrist party can't really convince everybody to be centrist when they feel aggrieved. You need to build coalitions of people who disagree and have a strong view here and a strong view there on one side or another, and then somehow spend political capital to smash them together.
Yeah, I think this is the fundamental problem going forward. I was out in San Francisco doing some events around this idea, and there was a fellow who convened a group of young presidents. It was a YPO organization, and the host said, look, I got two questions for you. Number one is, when was the last time government did something or failed to do something that made you really angry? And the table went aflutter, you know, all kinds of 5 minutes ago, government messed up, lots and lots of complaints. Question number two was, what did you do about it? And there was just this silence that settled over the table. And these are smart, motivated relatively altruistic people. So yes, it's easier to get the lunatics organized or to organize around people who feel passionate about one issue. But the things that face the country, the budget situation, entitlements, climate change, require that sane, pragmatic, moderate people actually mobilize.
Paul in Red Bank, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling because I think it's funny you guys are talking about this because I don't hear it talked about too often anymore, about centrism. I remember when I was in like late grade school, early high school, first learning about Theodore Roosevelt and the emergence of the Progressive Party, especially in the election of 1912. And when I read all about what they had stood for, I kind of thought, hey, that's me. And then found out, oh, but the party doesn't really exist anymore. It kind of, you know, he didn't win the election, so it's not really the political party anymore. I like the idea of the Progressive Party, not progressivism, but the Progressive Party being a more center where it was socially liberal to an extent, while simultaneously understanding that you needed moderate fiscal views in order to keep both the economy running and to allow for that social liberalism. And I never really feel like there's any politicians I can vote for who really have that kind of view. So I get in fights with all my friends, my conservative friends and my liberal friends.
Paul, thank you very much. Well, maybe there's your first party member, Professor Whelan.
Well, it wouldn't be the first. We already got some folks coalesced around it, but he makes a really good point, which is there are a large group of people, particularly young voters, who describe themselves as fiscally conservative and then either socially liberal, socially progressive, socially responsible. And the set of values that we briefly described, and certainly what I outline in the Centrist Manifesto, is consistent with that set of beliefs. Now, the progressive movement brings up another point about this, which is I think we have to think more about what government should and should not do as opposed to big government, small government. So as your last segment suggested, we need to invest in infrastructure. We need to protect against terrorists. We need to set up a set of rules and regulations around finance or the business won't work. We don't necessarily need to be paying for the health care of very wealthy people. We don't necessarily need to be subsidizing corn farmers and so on. It's a much more systematic look at what government helps us do communally and what things we can leave behind.
Gina and Elizabeth, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gina.
Hi. I called and I just heard what you guys were talking about on the system, and I have a real passion for that because I feel like I'm a fiscal conservative and a social liberal, someone who sees both sides and can't understand why they can't be in the middle, like parties can't be in the middle somewhere and really make differences and make changes where everyone wants us to be. Like, why does it have to be one or the other?
What's your fiscal conservatism? Where do you come down on a particular issue that represents that? Can you say?
Well, I'd say, you know, when it comes to taxes, I want to keep my money. I feel like I'm 25 years old. I work really hard to make what I want to make. And I feel like if I want to be able to give it away, which I do, I want to give, you know, 10% to my church, which has, you know, numerous, you know, liberal views where they give money to certain things. But I just don't want to be told where to put my money. I want to do what I want with it. But I want to still be able to help, you know, people that need to be helped.
Thank you for your call. Let's go right on to another caller. Mary Ann in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
And you call yourself a centrist.
I do. I mean, I give this stuff a lot of thought. And if, you know, if somebody were to ask me, I would say I'm a liberal. I'm like a total lefty liberal. It's like where I line up. But I have to say, like, the rhetoric on the left sometimes makes me even more angry than the rhetoric on the right.
I mean, like, the rhetoric on the
for example, all the populist talk from President Obama during and after Occupy Wall Street. You know, if you were to ask me, like, in principle, do I agree with those folks? A lot of the time, I do. And, you know, the people who caused the crash, and I do believe that there was irresponsible behavior that caused the crash, they should be accountable. So I line up behind people, you know, who want to do that. And yet at the same time, when I hear him talking about like us versus them, it really makes me angry because I don't think it advances the ball at all. And it just kind of fuels people like the Ann Coulters of the world, who I despise, but they're so ridiculous I can't even take them seriously.
Marianne, so you feel caught in the middle.
I do feel caught in the middle. I do feel caught, and it's really hard for me to find information rather than rhetoric. And that really bothers me.
Marianne, thank you for your call. And my guest is Charles Whelan, Dartmouth public policy professor and author of The Centrist Manifesto. So, Professor, she talks about President Obama, who would probably himself argue that he tries centrism over and over again and the Republicans reject it, that Obamacare was not single payer and did not even include a public option. It was something very private sector based, managed by the federal government. His deficit reduction is 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 spending cuts. He proposes modest gun reform and it gets rejected out of hand, even though 90% of the public endorses in the polls, background checks. He proposes two-party sacrifice in the Middle East and gets labeled anti-Israel. He proposes, to use another caller's example, trimming the entitlement programs, and it's not enough, and on and on. So Democrats would argue that they have become more and more centrist ever since the McGovern era gave way to the Bill Clinton era. But the Republicans keep drawing the center to the right by getting more and more radical, which a lot of Democrats would say calls into question your whole paradigm.
Well, there's some truth in that. It's certainly true that Obama has thrown things out that in a less toxic political environment would get some traction. And I think we should bring up the last piece of the centrist strategy here, which is we're not talking about electing a president. We're not even talking about electing members of the House, because those are both very difficult to do. The Electoral College makes it nearly impossible to elect a president. The whole strategy is built around electing centrist senators from a handful of states that are likely to be receptive to that message. And then take everything that you just mentioned and imagine a Senate that is 46 Republicans, 7 centrists, and 47 Democrats. At that point, your centrists are kind of like Anthony Kennedy, and the hope – and it is fanciful, but not crazy, is that those centrists act like the intellectual center of the court, again, like Kennedy in the Supreme Court, and the swing votes, and that they are the ones who can turn to right or left and say, look, we agree with you on this issue on the right, corporate tax reform. We agree with you on the left, say climate change, and we're willing to do business with whoever brings us the votes and brings us a good idea, and that might change the toxic climate, which is responsible for a lot of the good ideas that you described going nowhere.
By the way, there must be something in the way I framed the question today, or you're just really inspiring the heck out of people, because the lines are absolutely jammed. And we heard a sampling that within the amount of time that we have for this, a sampling that we could take of various callers who you heard describe themselves as centrists and with the various tugs that they feel from each side. We've got 10 lines on hold out of 10 that we have of people waiting to say similar things who we're not going to get to. So, folks, if you want to continue this conversation on our webpage, why don't you, budding centrists of the world, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehr Show and those who want to talk back to you and have a conversation online after we let Professor Whelan go. But WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. But as you go, you have a section of the book that is just labeled flat out the centrist party principles and goals. Are you trying to start a third party?
I think a third party is essential to actually break the gridlock. That I started out with this book 6 years ago was just kind of a nascent idea, and I thought about, can we reform one party or the other? Can we coalesce around the issues and get pragmatists to think, as we did with Simpson-Bowles, what the bipartisan approach might be to fiscal reform and so on? And I ultimately came to the conclusion, having watched politics, having participated in it, having studied public policy, that we actually need structural change, that you can't have people tethered to the primary system, where they have to say and do things that make them beholden to the extremes of their party. We can't expect those people who come out of that process to be centrists indeed. And therefore, I think we need actually folks who are supported by a separate political base, who come out of a separate process, who get to the Senate with a different governance strategy.
They tried that last year, didn't they? I forgot what the party was called, but they were supposed to get on the ballot in all 50 states, which I think they did, but then they couldn't find anybody with any name recognition to run.
Why they did the presidency completely escapes me. As I alluded to earlier, the Electoral College makes that a complete fool's errand. The approach needs to be the Senate. You can't gerrymander a Senate seat. You do not need a majority. 34% of the vote wins a Senate seat. You can win 34% of the vote just by holding the middle in about 20 or 22 states. There are 22 states that have a Republican senator and a Democratic senator, or a senator of one party and a governor from the other party. Those are places where a centrist candidate can win. And again, you get six or seven senators who are centrists, and now you are the folks who determine what happens.
All right. Toward a block of centrist party senators, Dartmouth College public policy professor Charles Whelan. His new book is The Centrist Manifesto. Thanks a lot.
Well, I'm glad we were able to get the lines to light up. Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, excerpts from a new play showing in a truck in New York about life at the U.S.-Mexico border. Stay with us.